because sometimes you do have to make slippery, buttery guesses.
Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture. Today's episode, Utter Breath. Before we get started, we have good news in the time of global plague apocalypse and otherwise terrible things all around.
Good
we have
news,
two
everyone.
New Patreon sponsors since the last time we had one of these chats. So
outstanding.
Big shout out of thanks to Paul Chomo, and who happens to host the Varmints. It's a podcast like ours, except instead of picking a word, they pick an animal and talk about an animal. So it's a critters podcast, which is cool.
Ooh.
I don't...
That's my official response to that description.
Ooh, yeah. I don't imagine that they were inspired overall by our special episode with Helen Zaltzman where we talked about varmints, but my headcanon is that they were. So thanks to Paul, and also to Jeremy from Boulder, Colorado, who has more recently signed up. Paul's been... patiently waiting for some recognition because it's been a while since we've actually recorded anything. But Jeremy was more recent. So yeah, two new Patreon sponsors, which is awesome. I actually...
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very much. I started looking into some sort of transcription things because I'd like to have episode transcripts. But the problem is... Our problem is sort of twofold. One is that we sort of have a... casual talk over each other whenever we feel like it style to us, and also
what are you talking about, we're consummate professionals
to never talk over each other. The other, as you've I know for a fact have encountered as well, and it's not just a hilarious meme about the Scottish, is that the Scottish accent is the bane of all things voice to text.
It really is, yeah, notoriously so.
I've tried automated stuff on our episodes before, little snippets or whatever, and I just end up writing out.
I
what
would
you're
like
saying.
To see that.
I just end up writing out manually every single thing you say because it just does. Like, she didn't say hamburgers
it's not
there.
Worth
what
it,
is going
it?
On? But yeah. So anyway,
yeah.
That's one of the things I'm looking.
I don't
into.
Know. I quite like the fact that the Scottish accent defies machine learning. I feel like, you know, in the Great War, that might come in useful.
Oh, I was just going to say, absolutely it will. Yeah. So
yeah.
So it'll pay off at some point, but right now it just makes
in the meantime,
automatic free transcription services not available to us. So I'm looking into what we can do
kind
as far as using
sucky.
Patreon money to give people episode transcriptions. But
well, yeah. I have a subscription to a transcription program called Transcribe, oddly enough.
That's, yeah.
But I use it exclusively pretty much for if I am studying and I have a video reference, like I much prefer to take in information by reading it than by listening to
it,
oddly enough, podcast lady.
Yeah.
But watching a video is fine, but I like to be able to read the information if it's something that I'm trying to learn and master. So I bought a transcription pedal in order to do that for a load of courses that I have that are video based.
Oh.
And I also use it for, you know, in the whole global apocalypse, I am still teaching 3 days a week.
Right. Yeah.
So in the absence of being able to actually online talk to my pupils, we're not allowed to do that in the authority that I work for like a whole bunch of procedural, protocol, legal type reasons.
Yeah.
So I have been making short instructional videos for various things that I've been teaching. And I feel like if I'm going to do that, I need to provide a transcription just in case. You know, learning from home is not inclusive already. So I feel like I have to make a bit of an effort to be as inclusive as I can be under the circumstances, because the lack of equity within home learning for kids in Scotland, it's pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
But so I've been doing that for short videos, and what I've found, you know, I'm not a touch typist. I'm just somebody who uses a keyboard a lot, and what I've found is that it takes about 2.5 times the length of whatever is being, whatever the recording is, to transcribe it.
Yeah.
For me personally, so, like. Yeah, that's a lot of time.
It's a big thing.
When you consider our episodes are, what, like 40 minutes,
yeah,
kind of thing?
Yeah, generally half an hour.
So I do technically have the means to do it, but I don't necessarily right now have the time to do it.
Yeah. But we'll figure it out, though.
But yeah.
Work
yeah,
in progress.
We can have a think about it.
Anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
So yes, thank you to Patreon people. And
patreon.com/lexitecture
if you want to join in the massive fun of supporting us financially. Woo!
Woo!
Yeah.
We heart financial support.
We do heart it. Heart it bad. Would you like to take it away this time around?
Oh, why ever not?
Why ever not?
Okay. The word I'm going to talk about is... it's one of these words where I had to actually go to the website of our own podcast and say, have I already talked about this word? Because it feels to me so obvious that I would have done that I can't believe I haven't yet.
I've had so many of those things happen.
Yeah, yeah. I have to check our website to make sure I'm not repeating myself more often than you would think feasible.
yeah, it's not. Yeah.
If I'm being perfectly honest.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so the word is breath.
Oh.
B-R-E-A-T-H. Now, one of the reasons why it feels hugely implausible to me that I've never talked about this word before is because I am borderline obsessed with the process of breathing.
Yeah,
ask
it's totally
any
your
of
jam.
My yoga students... and they will tell, yeah, it is my raspberry, strawberry, blackberry, any flavour you can think of, jam, 120%.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time, not just, obviously, we all spend a lot of time breathing. I spend a lot of time thinking about, learning about, optimising, deconstructing, and generally loving on the process of breathing. Also, and, you know, thanks to the divine Susie Dent, I do like to think of myself as a recovering prescriptivist. I'm not quite all the way to language hippie yet.
Right.
But, I'm it's a continuum. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
But people who don't know the difference between breath and breathe online make me wince to the max. It's one of my all-time top pet peeves of spelling.
Yeah.
Rivaled only, I would say, by lead and lead. But that's just a story for another day.
Mm.
But yeah, breath and breathe really rips my knit in, which is a good phrase that I enjoy a great deal.
That's a good phrase.
So, breath. Now, what I'm finding really interesting about this word is that, like, I started off, it occurred to me that I hadn't talked about this word. And I don't know if you do this, but before I actually started researching, I was trying to kind of make some guesses. How old is the word breath?
Right.
How long have people been talking about the process of breathing? Because, you know, fundamentally, as human beings, it's quite important. Like, if you can't breathe, you can't do anything else, you know?
Yeah.
And given that we're currently living through a global pandemic, with a serious respiratory illness, that has never been more apparent than right now in this time in history. Breathing is super duper important. Even if you're not obsessed by it, like me, you know, learning to breathe more efficiently and more effectively positively affects every single process that your body has to process. I say that without a word of exaggeration.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk to me about it in lots of detail, then please, please hit me up for some chat about breathing. I'm not going to bore you with it just now because this is not a breathing podcast. But if there was anyone out there who was going to have a podcast on breathing, I'd be on that team.
Yeah.
I would have to, like, I'm thinking the person who should really have a podcast on breathing is Dr. Kathy Dooley, who is a chiropractor and a physician. She has recently moved from New York to Boulder in Colorado, and she's an anatomist, and she's taught me a great deal about breathing. Anyway, besides that, so I figured that people would have been talking about breathing for a very, 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 very long time.
Yeah.
And I was actually a little bit surprised. Because what I found is that the oldest usage of the word breath doesn't technically apply to breathing. The OED gives it from around about 893. So, you know, we're talking about a long time ago.
Yeah.
But the meaning that's given for this 893 citation is odour, smell, or scent.
Oh.
In other words, anything could have breath.
Yeah.
And while we might, you know, the citation is very clear that it's about the sense of smell. And while it does, the other citations given, which range from 893 to around about 1540, do seem to be talking about the breath of people. But I found it very, very interesting that this is the oldest meaning of the word breath. And then I started to think about it and was like, actually, it's not that surprising if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 893, I'm going to go out on a limb here, not being much of a historian of physiology, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that people didn't know a great deal about physiology in 893.
Right.
And probably the process of breathing was something that people noticed. You know, if their chest moves up and down, then they're probably alive. And if it doesn't, then they're probably not. But it makes really good sense to me that this word would refer to something, I mean, not quite concrete, but something that is more easily observable than the kind of subtle movement of breath.
Right.
If someone has sweet-smelling breath, you would notice that. If someone has foul-smelling breath, you would notice that too. So
yeah,
I was really
surprised
by that.
It wouldn't be the general thing.
That.
It's kind of like that joke about the fish.
Yeah.
You know, what the hell is water? Like,
yeah,
it's
sure.
So basic, nobody actually bothers to write about it or really think about it, because except in exceptional, really good, really bad breath type of situations.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the earliest, as I say, the earliest usage, the earliest meaning is breath. And then we get to the second sense given by the OED, which is an exhalation or vapour given forth by heated objects. Steam, smoke, reek. This is another obsolete usage. But once again, it's a usage that relies on observation of I keep wanting to say tangible. It's not tangible, but
yeah.
Observation of something that the sort of thing that people notice. So what this made me think about, an exhalation or vapour, yesterday during the thunderstorm barbecue, it got a little colder. And my friend's little girl noticed that when she breathed out, she could see her breath.
Okay. Yeah.
And this kind of made me think about that. You know, you're going to have a word for that thing because you can see it. It's right there.
Yeah.
What's making that steam happen? Oh, it's breath. And then this citation, the earliest citation for this particular usage, comes from around about 1300. So a significant period of time has passed between breath as a smell and breath as a thing that you can see. We have lovely examples here, things like both of the sea and of fresh water, he draweth up the breath.
Ooh.
And then blood and fire and breath of smoke. I like the sense of the breath of smoke, almost as if it's alive. We then get following on from this meaning, the air exhaled from anything or impregnated with its exhalations and retaining its characteristic odour. So there's still this intertwined sense of breath being smell. And
right.
The best citation here of the ones that are given from 1874, what a student should specially see to is not to carry the breath of books with him wherever he goes. And the breath of books,
Yeah.
It made me think of me saying to you, smell the book.
Yes.
Because, you know, for people like us, the smell of books, we know it well.
Fantastic. Absolutely.
There's a lovely short story. I've probably told you about this before. There's a lovely short story called The Man Who Wanted to Smell Books. And it's set in a sort of a near future time where libraries don't really have books anymore, except kind of a few in their basement that they can't get rid of.
Right.
And this extremely odd character is going from library to library asking if he can smell the books. So eventually we get to sense number three, the air exhaled from the lungs, originally as made manifest by smell or as a visible exhalation. Hence, to keep or save or spare one's breath to cool one's own porridge. And this citation, the earliest date, is from around about 1386, from Chaucer's Pardoner's Tale.
Hmm.
Sour is the breath. So we still have this sense of odour being connected to this thing that people are observing.
Yeah, you only talk about when it's noticeable.
And then, yeah, sure, his breath smelling strong of alcohol. That's another one of the examples given. And then in 3B, we get generally the air received into and expelled from the lungs in the act of respiration.
Hmm.
To draw breath, to inhale air, breathe, hence to live. And this is now the main sense which colours all others. And interestingly, we're on another whole century almost, around about 1440, before we get this sense of breathing as in the process that keeps you alive.
Really?
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
I was really surprised by it. And while it does, you can kind of logic your way through how that works and how it's going. But I didn't expect that process to have taken such a long time. Of course, we always run into when we're looking at words that are as old as this, maybe people were using these words. We just don't have citations for them. But interesting nonetheless. I also checked out Etym Online because it's like my most favourite site on the whole internet, and found lots and lots of beautiful thorny old English ash letters, which, you know, they make me happy. They give me a little nerd shiver.
Yeah.
And so we have Old English breath, B-R, ash, thorn, odour, scent, stink, exhalation or vapour. And it says here that the Old English word for air exhaled from the lungs was ethym. So not only did breath mean smell, there was actually a different word for it in Old English in terms of the smell that comes from your mouth, you know, from your physiological process of breathing. And we get Proto-Germanic breathas, High German bradam and German brodem, meaning breath or steam. Etym Online suggests that this is perhaps from a pie root, gwer, one of these incredibly unpronounceable pie roots.
Right.
It's G-W-H-R-E, which they have here as to breathe or smell.
Hmm.
Now, it's a good day when you're researching a word and you get to Etym Online and there's a pie root and the pie root leads to a link and the link gives you a whole list of cognates.
Yes.
Occasionally, you get yourself to a pie root and there's no link and there are no cognates. And this was one of these, occasions. Now, sometimes, depending on the story of the word that I've kind of discovered thus far at that point in my research, sometimes that's enough for me to say, you know what, I don't think I'm going to have enough to talk about if I haven't got a pie root. I want to dive into some interesting cognates and, you know, my pie research isn't that great that I'm going to be able to find that very easily without having to do a ton of other reading. So sometimes I get lazy and I say, well, that word's off the list. But this time, I really wanted to talk about this word.
Yeah.
So I started to do a little bit of pie digging, and I remembered that the American Heritage Dictionary has an index of pie roots. This is a great resource that Ryan found quite recently. So I checked out there, and I generally started to do a bit of reading about pie dictionaries. And what I found was coming up again and again and again and again and again was pokorny. Lots of these other resources mentioned pokorny, as in pokorny states X or page such and such in pokorny. Mm. And so, of course, I wondered who pokorny was.
Yeah.
And I looked up Pokorny in the context of pie, and God bless the internet, here it is, an etymological dictionary of the Proto-Indo-European language by Julius Pokorny. PDF,
oh, so cool.
Whole thing. So
awesome.
Cool. So this is this can be found, if you're interested, on the website of the Indo-European Language Association, which is dnghu.org. Yeah, let's not go there with that. It's not hugely memorable, but that's the website of the Indo-European Language Association. And nice. I had a little look in this. Like, it's a vast tome. It's a 3,000 page PDF.
Wow.
So, you know, it's a big chunky book. And I had a little look. And I'm going to warn you right now that what comes next is, it's probably the folkiest of all folk etymology. And if people want to say, Amy, this is horse shit, I won't be offended, because I'm speculating a great deal here. And, you know, yeah. Like we say it often, I'm not a linguistic academic. I haven't got any formal training in linguistics. I'm well aware that I might be about to veer into dangerously speculative water.
Right.
So this dictionary, as is the case with most dictionaries, is alphabetical. And because it's a PDF document, I'm scrolling through. And I always feel like you kind of lose something with scrolling. If you're flicking through a dictionary, you have more of a sense of, you know, what's where you are, what's coming next, what's already been.
Yeah.
What I tend to do, especially with a big document, you know, you kind of, you roll the sidebar down to roughly where you think it's going to go, and you work from there.
Yes, yeah.
So completely by accident, while looking for this very difficult to pronounce root, Gwhere, G-W-H-R-E, I found myself looking at the entry Gwhere, G-W-H-E-R. So okay. Pretty close, we just have that slight inversion. Now, Gwhere, the supposed or suggested Pi root for breath, means smell or scent. But Gwhere, with E-R rather than R-E, means hot or warm.
Oh.
And I found that really, really interesting. So this gives us Armenian word gma, blaze or glow or heat. We get all these words in various languages. Old Persian, the heat, warm, harvest, thought to, from Greek we get theros.
Oh,
sorry, theros, meaning harvest, therome, to become hot, and thermos, warm,
right.
a familiar one, and thermasa, oven. So I find that quite interesting, because when you're considering smell and when you're considering vapour or smoke, what's going to happen for those things to be going on? Well, there has to be heat somewhere. So I found myself wondering, I suppose, about the etymology of pie, about how linked and how related these different roots are. Now, I'm not nearly qualified enough to be able to answer that question, but I did find it very, very interesting in my travails through Pokorny's book that this root, so close to the root for the root that I was looking for, has such an interestingly related meaning.
Yeah.
And then then there was Gwhren, which is G W H R E N.
Okay.
And what's particularly interesting about this root, the English meaning is given by Pokorny as phrenic / soul / mind.
Oh.
Now, the word phrenic I'm familiar with, but you may not be familiar with the word phrenic, P-H-R-E-N-I-C, because you're probably not as interested in the anatomy of breathing as I am. But phrenic, and specifically in the human body, the phrenic nerve, innervates the diaphragm, which is the principal muscle of respiration.
Yeah.
And the reason that the phrenic nerve is called the phrenic nerve is because the Greek word phrenos means diaphragm.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Interestingly enough. I like that one, because diaphragm itself comes from a Greek word, but the PHR phragm part of diaphragm and the PHR phrenic part, they're the same.
Okay.
So the phrenic nerve innervates the diaphragm, which helps us to breathe. And here we have this list of pirates talking about smells and heat. And the word phrenic pops up, which seems to me a particularly lovely coincidence, if it's a coincidence. And I would really, really love to know if there are any pie academics out there listening to this podcast. You probably have a lot of horrified faces and noises to go through while you listen to our stylings. But I would really love to know how related pirates are. Whether or not that's a question that can in fact be answered.
Right.
Or whether it's something that we just have to say, you know, meh, who knows, could be.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was very pleased to find that the diaphragm came up in my etymological explorations of the word breath.
That's very interesting. So cool. I love these little loopy things. I also love finding 3,000-page old obscure dictionary PDF versions online. That's super cool.
I put it in the folder.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, you should be able to see it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I do like that idea that, and it is, and same disclaimers, obviously, like, but just how close they are. And it's like, yeah, I mean, hot and smell and soul and, you know, like, yeah, that's very interesting.
I mean, it's worth pointing out that in between guer and guer, one with er and one with re, there are lots of other GW starting words. So like if I go through, you know, if I scroll through from GWHER, meaning hot or warm, the next entry is GWH thorn EI.
Whoa.
I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce that. Yeah, it doesn't even look like any sort of language I know of. And that one means to perish or to destroy.
Well, that makes sense because the only way you could pronounce that is actually just to record someone having their tongue cut out, I think.
And then we get gwther, which is to run or to flow. I feel like I'm speaking Klingon. It's great.
Oh,
and then
amazing.
We get gwren, phrenic or soul or mind.
Right.
And then we get gwre, which is to smell or to scent.
To smell or scent.
So, yeah, I certainly wouldn't say that all of this whole section of the dictionary, all of these words are interrelated. Or if they are, then I'm not clever enough or well-informed enough to know what those specific connections are. But I did find it very interesting.
Yeah, that is very cool. Awesome.
Breath.
Breath. Very cool. Mine is slightly related, I guess. And it's definitely related in the sense that I had another one of those things where I was looking through this and I kind of had questions and I started researching and then went, I must have done this before. This is, and I think part of what it is that I'm a very sloppy researcher in that I don't document what I research all the time. Like I'll have an idea and I'll run to the OED and I'll take a look and be like, oh, that'd be a cool one. And then I will utterly neglect to do any sort of writing down of the thing that I've found or make a note to myself to look after it later. And then like 3 days later, I'd be like, right, time to look into that word.
Here is my equivalent sort of illustration of how much I am that person too. How many tabs do you currently have open on your phone?
Like 30. It's so many.
I'm counting right now.
It's just so many. It's too many is what it is. But, yeah.
24. Good I'm currently grief. On 24.
Yeah it's
yeah,
definitely
and they
that.
Range from, they range from such topics as, there's an essay by James Baldwin. There's a search for a dietary supplement that I saw advertised on TV and thought, that thing doesn't help you to lose weight, does it? There's a whole lot of etymology research. There's some biomechanics in there. There are a couple of videos of people falling over and dogs and cats doing stupid things. Like, you know, I feel like the tabs, the browser tabs open on your phone is like a little kind of snapshot of your mind. And I don't know that mine is necessarily all that. Well, I don't know that I want other people to know about it.
Yeah.
She says, talking about it on a podcast.
Yeah, exactly. This is the wrong place to not want people to know about the thing you're talking about, but that's okay. Yeah, so and often then I think what happens some of the time is I'll then come back to those words later and it looks familiar to me because at some point I spent an afternoon researching it and then just got lost. And so sure. Then I swear we did it already. Anyway, long story short, far too late. My word is utter.
Ooh.
U-T-T-E-R. So the actual, like the first time, this is one of those ones I've been meaning to look up for kind of a while. And it's one of those sort of, inducing ones that are just enough to make you interested, but not quite interested enough to actually look it up right away. And it's because, this is going to come as a huge shock to everybody I know, but brace yourselves, make sure you're sitting down. The legal profession has a lot of jargon in it. I know.
No.
I know. You're just going to have to trust me on this. So, and one of the things that I found kind of an interesting theme, because now I've sort of been paying attention to it, is how many words do, like, the written origins of them are in fact in some sort of legal sense, like whether it's a law or a statute or just like the legal importation of Latin, because we all have to sound as smart as possible and Latin is obviously the only way to do that.
I'd imagine one of the reasons for that is that legal documents are kept, they're important and they're stored. They're really, really good sources for etymological research, I'd imagine, because, you know, we have them. And we have them for a long, we've had them for a long time.
Yeah. So the context I first sort of went, wait, is there's a charge, like a thing you can be guilty of in Canada called, and the charge is uttering a forged document. And I kind of went, that's weird, because when you utter something, it's an audible thing. So uttering a document seemed weird to me. And I kind of put it in that little place in my brain for weird things to go that I should look up but don't. And then I think about sometimes...
That place gets clogged up a lot, doesn't it?
It's just so, like, jammed up. The door barely closes
I kind of wish you could... Like, you know how you can, like, get professionals to shoot strong chemicals down your drains and clear them out when they're clogged? Sometimes I wish there was the equivalent of that for brains.
Yeah.
Anyway, continue. That's true.
The other thing that's kind of been inducing is just how different the verb and the adjective are from each other. Because the two simultaneous uses are like the verb to utter something or the adjective that person is an utter idiot or something. And so those are different, and that was weird to me. And
utterly, yeah. Oh, I'd never considered that before.
And the adverbial thing. And so the current adjective usage, meaning like complete, total, entire, whatever, and the related adverbial, utterly, it's been, basically the OED describes it as being in very frequent use since around 1515. So not as old as you might think, but it's been around for a while and it's meant this for, you know, five centuries. But as an adjective in general, it goes back another 600 years to around 900 AD. And the earliest usage for utter as an adjective was, in the definition given by the OED, situated in the outer or exterior part, manifesting on the exterior. Because
Uttar Pradesh!
Yeah. Etymologically, utter just started as another form... I mean, if not another form, a very, very close relative of outer. And so...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So we have...
Outer Mongolia.
Yeah. And so we have situated on the outside as the earliest adjectival form of it, which, like, I can see kind of a couple different paths on how it got from one to the other. So, like, the one thing I picture is, like, a three-dimensional space... that has become so full of something that it is finally, the substance has reached the outer extremity of it.
So rather like the door won't close section of your mind where the weird stuff goes.
Exactly. So if something is on the outer extremity in a sense of being full, then you can think of If you're an utter something, it's you're full all the way to the outside. And I guess the other side is the idea of manifesting on the exterior means that it's visible and noticeable to others. And so originally, if someone was an utter something, it's just it's so obviously on the outside is that thing. And so I'm not sure exactly how
this is really cool
how it got there, but I can see both of those working. But I like both of them. And that brings us to the verb form of utter, which goes back to about 1400, and the earliest uses are, I mean, now the give voice to that we currently know as the verb did also start in the early 1400s. But the very earliest ones in the OED, the first one in the OED, is just to publish or issue or send forth, as in to put out, to release out.
As in your documents.
As in uttering a document. Okay. You'd publish things. So the earliest use, like Chaucer's in there with a usage about putting something out into sort of the public market for sale.
And this comes back to that sense of outer, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's
getting it out there.
Getting it out there.
Yeah.
And so
that's lovely.
There's another one where the verb utter meant to pass money around, to exchange money, or to produce money into circulation was to utter it. And a bunch of other, but basically that sense of just emission or issuing or putting forth is why utter means that and why it could originally. It's super technical, and it's basically the only time you hear it is in a legal context now for uttering documents. But it's actually, that definition is just as old. It just happens to have fallen out of use, and in the early 1500s it took over as the spoken, you know, the audible utterance version of it took over.
That's super cool, because there is a particular connotation within utter, as in to talk. Like, it's like the whole, you know, the whole using a thesaurus when you don't speak the language can be tricky. Utter doesn't quite mean the same as said. Mm-hmm. But if you were to ask me what the difference was between the two, I might struggle to define exactly what it is that creates that difference.
Well, you know, but who doesn't struggle at that?
Who doesn't struggle at that?
Smith doesn't struggle at that.
Oh, delicious.
And
rustle the pages.
I ruffled the pages because somebody incredibly amazing actually sent me, as a total surprise, a physical copy of Smith's Synonyms Discriminated. Woo! So I have it in my hand that I will treasure it forever, and it's amazing. And I got to actually flip pages of Smith to find these things, which was also awesome. So Smith picks up on that exact same thing. That sense of uttering isn't quite the same as speaking. It's not quite the same as articulation. But again, the question is how. And this is an absolutely perfect example of what this book is for. So utter shows up in two different places in Smith. One of them is under the entry for deliver, which also has pronounce and utter. And what Smith says about that is he says, quote, "Of these, utter, to put forth or out, is the simplest. To utter a speech is simply to sound it with the voice as so many words. So the word utterance is applied to mere inarticulate sound as to utter a sigh or a moan." And so there's one differentiation. The other one is under pronounce, which also has utter, articulate, and deliver as the synonyms being discriminated. And what he says here is, "What is given forth by the voice as mere sound may be said to be uttered. What is spoken in distinct syllables is articulated. What is spoken in harmonious, proportioned, and sustained articulation is pronounced as words or sentences. And what is given forth by sustained pronunciation is delivered. Thus do these terms grow upon one another as sound, syllables, words, and speech."
I'm currently uttering all sorts of satisfied academic noises.
Yeah.
That's just so beautiful. You know the thing is, as well, with Smith, I don't even care if that's true or not. You know,
exactly.
Part of my brain, when I hear a list like that, when I hear someone say so absolutely convincingly and you know, factually these are the difference between these words. Part of my brain goes, is that really true? Where is your evidence for this? Well, how did you come to this conclusion? But with Smith, I am so taken away by the prose that he uses that I actually don't, that part of my brain just melts away, just shuts down completely. And it goes, yes, Smith, that is
absolutely
the case. Utterances, noises, speech, just beautiful.
Yeah. So there's utter, both in documents and speech and publishing and money and spoken things and grunts and noises and everything else.
It's so great. What I was kind of thinking about the sense of what makes utter different from speak, and I think there is almost this sense of like uncontrolled, I had to.
Right, get like it a reflex.
There, you know, and yeah, and it's that space between keeping words in your head and sending them out into the world, and sometimes that happens because, you know, you want it to, and sometimes it almost happens involuntarily. And so I was thinking about, you know, as an utterance, like an exclamation, and I think that an exclamation has that sense that you're not just saying it, you're making it loudly known. You know, it's something that you don't have any problem with anybody else hearing. It's being exclaimed with that X sense of getting out that utter also has. But from now on, I shall always think of those times when my brain seems to just circumvent the part of me that makes decisions and noises come out of my mouth. From now on, that's an utterance. And that probably happens more often than I would think about.
Yeah. And also I just looked up, because it just occurred to me that one of the things I might have a question about if I was listening to this, I might go, hey, what about mutter? And because it has the same kind of general sense of not necessarily articulated, but still put out there and spoken. Not related, according to Edom Online. I haven't looked up any deeper than just quickly on Edom Online, but different from a different pyroot. So maybe that'll be another thing that we go into someday, because I think we've already done it, but haven't. But mutter and utter are not directly linguistically related, although in most senses they kind of are. But yeah. But yeah. Utter. Yeah.
I suppose it's not entirely unlike me wading through a Pi dictionary and going, hey, they kind of sound the same. I wonder if they have any.
Yeah, exactly.
Because utter isn't related to mutter, and I presume it isn't related to butter either. But, you know, it would be really, really cool if it was.
I want it to be so bad.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, that's fantastic. Love it. So, yeah.
I'm really glad that etymology isn't a real science, in that, I mean, obviously it is a real, what I mean is it's not just a science, because sometimes you do have to make slippery, buttery guesses. I guess that there's probably a lot of people who find that really dissatisfactory, but for me, it's all part of the charm.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. To get in touch with us about something you heard in this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.